Blog Talk Radio.
Thursday night, and you know what that means. It is time for the latest edition of the four-time award-winning Politically Direct, and certainly coming to you live from the Blog Talk Radio studio here in the heart of Huntington County, folks. You know, it is always in Union City, New Jersey. I'm proud to partner with Insider NJ, New Jersey's leading political news website, and of course I am New Jersey's premier and award-winning political commentator, the most professional journalist, and your culture warrior, Fernando Uribe. I want to thank you all tonight for joining us here on the 29th of July. We're wrapping up the month. And again, folks, August is right around the corner and the summer's flying by, but we're still going strong here on Blog Talk Radio. Now, if you wish to reach out to the show, ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions or comments or maybe suggestions for future guests, write to the show. I love getting email. I look at my inbox every single day. So it's politicallydirectnj@yahoo.com. Of course, make sure you follow the show on Instagram @politicallydirectnj. I've been a little laxed with updating the page, but I will get to it. But of course, you can check out my own personal Instagram @ProfessorFernandoUribe. Tons of new followers, plenty of likes. I know many of you enjoy my Instagram stories, whether it's about pro wrestling, politics, sports, pop culture, whatever it is. I always have something to say, and I'm not shy about it on my Instagram, so definitely check it out. And also hit me up on Twitter, folks, @NoFilterUribe. That's @NoFilterUribe. And for all of you Facebook subscribers, please go to the official page for Politically Direct. Like it, of course, and tell your friends to do the same. Now, I do want to hear from you tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Of course, you, my loyal listening audience here every week on insidernj.com/podcasts. Of course, you can call me toll-free at 818-572-8032. Again, toll-free number tonight. I'll take some calls later in the show if you're just coming on with myself and special guests you have on this evening. Folks, call in. Love to hear from you, of course. And our toll-free number is brought to you by Insider NJ. Now, don't forget to check out Insider NJ, ladies and gentlemen, by going to www.insidernj.com for the absolute best coverage of the political scene throughout the state of New Jersey. And nobody does it better than Insider NJ. Again, I'm proud to be a part of the Insider NJ family. Can't say enough about the Graham family specifically. Mike Graham, not just because he cuts me a check, but obviously being the head of this operation and certainly having and bestowing so much faith on me and this program, I'm just eternally grateful to him. I'm certainly my Insider NJ general manager, Pete Onelia, who's not always a fan of me dropping his name on the air, but, you know, he's a great boss to work for. I know I can be a pain in the butt for him, but he manages me pretty well, so I'm grateful to him. And, of course, folks, you know, as someone who's played organized sports, you know, I understand the importance of teamwork and team camaraderie because at the end of the day, you know, game time, you know, you kind of put feelings aside and whether or not you like your colleagues and you work together to produce the best news site in the state of New Jersey. So I'm proud to contribute that every single week here on the podcast via Blog Talk Radio. But of course, when you check out the main page, upper right-hand corner, ladies and gentlemen, you'll see the subscribe button. Click on it. and you'll be automatically enrolled in the morning intelligence briefing. So when you're watching TV in the morning, having breakfast, going to work, or I don't know, maybe just working out, walking your dog, right? You're probably scrolling through your inbox, you know, checking out your email, what junk mail you don't want to look at, or looking at bills or looking at important newsletters. Guess what? When you wake up, the morning intelligence briefing will be right there waiting for you. Again, the latest columns, what's going on in Jersey politics. It is an election year here in the Garden State. So we have a gubernatorial election, legislative races, and certainly local municipal races as well throughout this year. And certainly it all culminates coming up on Election Day, November the 2nd, later this fall. So again, Insider NJ does it better than anybody else, ladies and gentlemen, because they give you all the information you need and they give you up-to-the-minute resources and certainly breaking news as it becomes available, whether it's our excellent editor-in-chief, Max Pizarro, other great columnists on the site, or even yours truly here, who breaks news every now and then on the broadcast live on Thursday nights. You certainly want to keep supporting Insider NJ. So again, check it out at www.insidernj.com. Make sure you like Insider NJ on Facebook and also follow Insider NJ on Twitter. Remember to start and end your day with Insider NJ. As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, the opinions and views expressed tonight and every week here on Politically Direct with Fernando Uribe are mine and mine alone. They do not represent those of Insider NJ, the management, the journalists, or the staff. Folks, we've got a great guest coming up in just a few moments. So you certainly want to, again, you don't want to go anywhere. You want to stay right where you are. Certainly, I do want to give you sort of a heads up here, folks. If you have not had a chance to check out the Institute of Judicial Conduct, please go to their website. There is a plethora of information there that gets you up to speed on how important this nonprofit organization is when it comes to examining judicial conduct in the nation's capital, and certainly as an issue that, quite frankly, should dominate the news cycle and headlines everywhere. So we have a great guest come up in just a few moments to discuss that. And, of course, again, in the meantime, you can check out judicialconduct.org for more information. And certainly, again, folks, 1-855-728-0032, our toll-free number tonight. I'll take some calls later in the show. And I can't say enough, ladies and gentlemen, again, as you know, as we're wrapping up the month of July, 2021 has been a great year for Politically Direct, great traffic, wonderful guests. I've interviewed a lot of legislative candidates, both Republicans and Democrats here in New Jersey, as well as incumbent legislators also. And folks, listen, it goes without saying that it's an important election year here. You want to have a better sense of the direction that the state's going in. I've talked about it, you know, repeatedly in terms of the economic downward spiral that we're heading here in the Garden State with irresponsible spending, just bad budgetary practices in Trenton as well. But you have a chance to change all that, folks, on November the 2nd, coming up not just in the gubernatorial election, but also when it comes to legislative races. So, you know, I'll let you make a decision for yourselves, but you know where I stand on economic policies. I'm as conservative as it gets on it. And it seems so much about being conservative, liberal, or progressive. I mean, I would always argue that when it comes to being good with money or being good with budgets or budgeting correctly, I don't think that's something that should be political. I think it's just something that should be just downright rational. And we don't always have that in Trenton. So, you know, I'll keep, you know, beating the drums here on this show. I'm one of the few journalists anywhere in the state that talks about this stuff. You know, you don't see this being discussed too much on the other, you know, news institutions here in New Jersey. And that's disappointing when you have longtime staples like NJ.com, you know, via the Star Ledger with Tom Moran. I mean, occasionally he'll write a good column once in a while. But if it's not Tom Moran, you know, espousing ultra-liberal policies or viewpoints, I mean, it's not always worth reading him. Or, you know, checking out Uncle Dave, you know, David Cruz with NJTV. You know, he's a guy who's been a staple in the business for some years. But as you can tell, when you look at his Twitter feed or whatever, he's just become complacent. It's not really about, I think, discussing the most pertinent things in New Jersey politics. I think it's just complacency now. And that's symptomatic, folks. I think it's symptomatic with other news organizations. You see it with Charles Stile. Nice guy. I like him. I've had him on the show. But, you know, we have to be honest here on the show and call things out. So NorthJersey.com is just as guilty of it. The Trentonian, the Asbury Park Press. And even to some extent, you know, I might get in trouble for saying this, but even on Insider NJ, know, some of my colleagues, you know, don't have what I would argue is the best political IQ, and it, sometimes it shows in their columns. They're great writers. I mean, I can sort of separate the two distinctions. You know, one, you know, you can be a good writer, but by the same token, you know, you may not know what the hell you're talking about. And sometimes that's pretty symptomatic in New Jersey media folks. So I'm always very cautious about that. But, you know, again, you know, this is something that we've been very, very fortunate to have here on the show, because not many, you know, news shows, whether it's podcasts like this or weekly columnists, are really talking about issues that matter to regular everyday people. I get it, it's the summer. Sometimes people get sort of, you know, again, and we're back to being reopened, right? At this time last year, we were still home, basically. The state was not reopened yet, right? We were still wearing masks. Businesses were so closed. So, I mean, it's good to be out and about a year later, but it still doesn't mean that journalists in New Jersey are really doing their job and reporting on issues that matter to everyday people, whether it's about mask mandates that are being discussed about being revisited, or the idea about what we expect as it pertains to proper conduct by our legislators, by members of the judiciary. I mean, these are everyday topics that should matter to people, and that's not being discussed by other journalists in New Jersey, except by me. And that's something I take a lot of pride in, because that's what makes Politically Direct not just a four-time award-winning podcast, but what I would argue is the most reputable political podcast in New Jersey media. So, and the reason that it continues to be is because half the battle is getting interesting and thought-provoking guests. And of course, this week is no exception. And I'm happy to bring to the show tonight, he's the founder and the president of the Institute of Judicial Conduct. I mentioned it just earlier in the show. Again, you can check out judicialconduct.org. You can donate, obviously, on the homepage there. There's a wealth of information there. There's a plethora of resources you can have at your disposal there from any PC, Mac, smartphone, or tablet. So you can read up more about the importance of the Institute of Judicial Conduct. And once again, here's its president and founder, Mr. Manuel Asensio, joining us tonight here on Politically Direct. Manuel, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Fernando.
It's good to have you here. So, Manuel, let's get right to it here, because as I alluded to earlier in the broadcast, and as I made reference to the Institute itself, obviously information that's very vital, you know, as briefly as possible, because sometimes we have to sort of make things very compact for a listening audience, what prompted you to come up with the idea of the Institute of Judicial Conduct?
Well, there's a personal reason why I'm running for Congress in the 118th and why I created the Institute of Judicial Conduct, and that's my daughter and my personal family issues. But those personal family issues became a constitutional matter, and I discovered that Roberts and the chief judges of the U.S. Judicial Conference have fabricated a policy that do not allow any American in any state to get into the federal court system to protect themselves from judicial corruption in this, in any one of the 3,400 counties or the 50 states concerning their most unassailable rights, the right to raise their children as conservatives, as believers in God, or believers in country, or believers in the first Constitutional Congress, the Second Constitutional Congress, the deliberations that went on in those Congresses about the revolution, going into revolution, creating the army that went against England and then declared war, of course, declared war, and then went through the process of the Federalist Papers and created the Constitution that we live under, and then the Bill of Rights. We have no protection for anyone in America in family court of their constitutional liberty and freedom that is given to them as their birthright as Americans. It's part of their passport, for crying out loud. And if they got away with this, they can get away with everything. And we saw what they got away with during the Trump administration. And I decided to create a completely independent body to help Americans understand that they have all they need to discern what is right and wrong under the Constitution, and the judges should not be doing it without juries, and the judges should not be doing it at all. These are things that are not cannot be governed, no matter what process is provided by government, and that's really at the heart of the leftist movement, the success of the leftist movement in America. So that's why I created the Institute of Judicial Conduct. It is completely independent of the judiciary and the judiciary infrastructure, which includes all of the bar associations in the states and the legal scholars. Jurisprudence is a big word. We were all philosophers in our own rights, and we're all experts in what is right and wrong in our own rights, and we don't need judges and lawyers to tell us what is right and wrong. We need Americans to know that we've got to regulate the federal judges, and we've got the power to regulate federal judges under the Judicial Conduct Act of 1980, which was signed by Jimmy Carter on October 15th, just a few days before he lost the election and lost both the House and the Senate. The Democrats lost the House and Senate to Ronald Reagan. And since that happened, we've never heard from this law again. So I'm trying to bring it back.
Well, Manuel, it's interesting.
That's my reasons.
No, well, listen, and it's thorough, and I appreciate that detail, because I think it's important for our audience to understand how judicial conduct is really a subject matter, as you just discussed, that has gone under the radar. Obviously, we're talking about more than 40 years now since Jimmy Carter, obviously, signed this into law, and it was one of those things that, as you mentioned, he would lose the election in quite an overwhelming fashion just a month later to Ronald Reagan. And since then, this has really not been discussed, I think, in intellectual and academic circles as well. So, and we'll get into the bread and butter of the Institute a little bit more in a moment, but I'm really curious, what's been the feedback and or response that you've gotten from professionals, because I know you have an excellent network. You talk to a lot of attorneys. You talk to others that are really politically connected to some extent. What's been the feedback and or the response to you creating the Institute, and, again, the response to the issues that you're trying to warn the public about and raise awareness about?
Well, first of all, whenever you talk to a judge and a lawyer, you're talking to an individual who has been indoctrinated in the belief that they have more power than we do. They glorify judges because you need, obviously, civility in a court of law, not that the judges act civilly. So that already is a problem. That meaning trying to have a dialogue with a lawyer who was trained to argue and trained to believe that he knows something we don't know about law or about the legal process is a very difficult thing. And I'm talking about the higher level, especially the lawyers that practice on the federal bench in the district courts or in the Court of Appeals or at the Supreme Court. A lot of them that practice don't know that the real job, the real power of the federal bar, the federal bench, the 2,400 lawyers, come from the fact that 14 of them get together at the conference and decide what's right and wrong. I mean, I've been trying to get through to Trump to explain to him that the 50 injunctions that were entered against his presidency, his presidential power, including preventing him from putting on the citizenship question on the census, and I don't want to drift, but just think about this. You're the president. You have Article II rights to determine what is constitutional in the country or not. And no matter what, you can step in and pardon anyone if you think that justice and laws were executed unfaithfully to the Constitution. The faithfulness of the Constitution is only in the hands of the president. But as a result of the Judicial Conduct Act, the faithfulness to the Constitution of any legal process is reviewable by a simple complaint entered in plain language in any one of the 13 judicial councils in the United States. There's one judicial council at each of the Court of Appeals. There's 13 Court of Appeals. So there's, let me just talk a little bit more. These are statistics that I've grown to know. I talk to federal lawyers all the time that are not familiar with this. There's only 13 courts of appeal. They have a chief judge. That chief judge also acts as the chief judge of the judicial council, and he's charged as being the cop on the beat. So you show the report to him. If you don't like the way it went, you have a chance to appeal to the judicial conference, and the judicial conference is controlled by the 13 of them plus the other chief judge, the chief judge of the Supreme Court, and there you have it. So what's happening, and I don't want to go too long, but what's happening is that those 14 men and women are violating the separation of powers in order to violate the separation of church and state. That's what Americans are feeling, that kind of oppression, that kind of coercion. And that's what gives people like AOC the ability to speak. She's just a thing, right? There's a lot of power behind that, but how is it that Americans?
Mm-hmm. I'm listening. No, I'm sorry to cut you off.
Why is it the Republican Party and the Democratic Party not talking about the issue? The issue is the violation of the separation of powers by these judges. They're talking to the Department of Justice, so the Department mm-hmm. of Justice won't prosecute them for committing fraudulent acts, which are treasonous, in constitutional issues on the bench.
Well,
That doesn't happen. That doesn't happen under any president. It's certainly not going to happen on this president because we've got a federal judge, who was central to what the federal judges did to Flynn after Barr wanted to release General Flynn, right?
Mm-hmm.
That man, Merrick Garland, is now the head of the Department of Justice, a judge. The head of the Department of Justice. Now not separated at all from the administration. Meanwhile, in Trump, he couldn't do anything with Barr. Barr was untouchable, a power unto
his
own.
Let's talk about that for a minute because there are political implications here that you referenced, and it seems that both parties have been very lackadaisical in addressing these issues about the judiciary. And, something that we learned, folks, if you just join us right now, it's 9:23 on the East Coast here on Blog Talk Radio. It's my pleasure to have on with me tonight on Politically Direct, the founder and president of the Institute of Judicial Conduct, which you can find out more information about this organization at www.judicialconduct.org. Once again, it's Manuel Asensio here tonight on Blog Talk Radio joining us. Now, Manuel, as I mentioned, it seems that from a very young age, we learn obviously about civics and we learn about the three branches of government and how they work independently of each other. And the founders and the framers, collectively, were very specific in the writing of the document and making sure that, one branch of government doesn't grow more powerful than the other. Again, it was sort of the importance of the checks and balances that was written into the Constitution. And again, the framers were really insistent on this. They knew what tyranny was. They had to live through the tyranny of King George and the monarchy of England. And again, in this experiment, that we are living in right now, let's be honest. I mean, it's a 245-year experiment. I mean, we're an infant on the world stage when it comes to countries and societies and democracies. The framers were specific about making sure that this new form of government, that this new experiment could function and the branches of government could function independently of each other, but also work together. It seems to me, at least what I'm hearing from you, what I can read on the website of the organization, it just seems like one branch has grown too powerful. Is that fair to say?
One branch is treasonous. You cannot allow the federal. Look, Roberts' power doesn't come from being the chief judge of the Supreme Court. Roberts' power comes from being the presiding officer of the judicial conference, the chief executive officer of the administrative office of the U.S. courts, the chairman and controlling person of the federal judiciary center, and the federal judiciary foundation. Those are huge. That's a tremendous amount of power in one man. He distributed it between one or two or three of the 14 of these judges, these chief judges. They're chief judges of the judicial, the intermediary division between the trial courts. There's 93 trial courts and the Supreme Court. There's 13 U.S. Court of Appeals. They're called the circuit courts. So there's 13 chief judges. They're in there too, and they do deals. They do deals. They have secret proceedings. They take secret oaths among themselves. There's no doubt about that. That is why Trump lost the election. Trump lost the election because they made him look like a racist, and they created 50 illegal injunctions, state national injunctions, nationwide injunctions against his power to administer the immigration laws, which is what he was put in for. So there's no doubt that there is an open border policy that has been approved at the judicial conference that allows misconduct by the district court judges to issue these nationwide injunctions, 50 of them, it was 50 of them in 4 years. And we can talk about the legality and illegality of nationwide injunctions against the president's power by a mere district court trial judge. And we can talk specifically about one or two of those cases, most importantly, the right of the president to put the citizenship question back on the census that Obama, and only Obama in the history of the nation, took off the census. But Trump couldn't put it back, and Obama could take it off. And Roberts approved that in a 5-4 decision. Why did he do that? A mindless 5-4 decision, which is 30,000 words, a man that says, look, you should never write that much about a decision because people won't understand it. Anyway, so this is a lot of information for your audience.
No, of course. I apologize, I'm talking too much. No, that's fine, Manuel. I like specificity. I think it helps our audience understand complex issues, which sometimes, don't always necessitate, a succinct answer. Not everything, as I tell my students all the time, in teaching political science and U.S. history, not everything is always available in two or three sentences. Sometimes you have to be very detailed when it comes to giving an audience a better understanding of an issue. And let me just add something to what you just mentioned earlier. I would also argue, too, I think what contributed to the 45th president losing reelection is, and I think it's something that they learned their lesson about, come hell or high water, we started in New Jersey. We started in a lot of blue states. Not that New Jersey was ever going to turn red anyway. New Jersey has not gone red since George H.W. Bush in 1988. So it's a long time in New Jersey politics. But in other prominent states, the Carolinas, Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, it seems like, I'm not trying to give them credit, but I have to be objective here. It seems like Democrats at the state and national levels just did a better job of registering people. Listen, I was a fan of the president along policy lines for a lot of reasons. I wasn't always a fan of his character or lack thereof, but I could justify and rationalize to people, hey, this is why he deserves another 4 years. And whether or not people judge me for that, I don't care. But the point was my answers were predicated on policy. But getting back to another reason why he lost, I would just argue, Manuel, that he also lost because Democrats did a better job of just signing up people to registering to vote. And I think that machine, that mobilization worked wonders for them in states that they lost in 2016. I'll be very honest. I just think Democrats didn't take him seriously in 2016. They felt that Hillary was going to win in a landslide, and they didn't mobilize voter registration drives the way they did in 2020. Like, they were like, okay, we learned a lesson. We're not going to make that mistake again. We're not going to underestimate them. We're going to try to register everybody from here to the moon. I think that's a big reason why Democrats not only won the White House, why they kept the House, and why they literally won the Senate. I mean, I think that's an angle people don't think about either, Manuel.
Well, I don't know if we should enter into a debate about our opinions of what happened in 2020 between the virus and the Black Lives Matter rioting.
Sure.
And the changes in the processes to elect in a haphazard, improper manner.
I'm no expert
at that, and I don't go into that debate. But I will tell you that calling the president a racist and saying that he's a racist because he wanted to put the citizenship question on the ballot, that is a way of indoctrinating the nation to believe that we are not exceptional. We are not a nation that was created in trust of God and under God. And there's only two of them in the world, Israel and America. We are an exceptional nation.
No, that's
true. We are.
You mentioned that
the founding fathers studied England. They didn't just study England. The founding fathers read and spoke Latin, read and spoke Hebrew, read and spoke Greek, and studied.
Yeah, they read the Magna Carta.
Magna Carta, but we have to go further. And these people were looking for virtue, and they understood that what was wrong in the world was human character, and that we needed to keep America free and have limited government. And the federal judges are not, you know, well, look, now, so when you, what my point is that when you call the president a racist and you allow, when Roberts allowed Jesse Furman here in the Southern District call Wilbert Ross, a member of Congress, into New York to be deposed by New York State to ask him why he wants to put the citizenship question on the census to determine whether he was a racist and whether Trump was a racist. Come on. I mean, it's got to have had some impact on the turnout. It's got to have some impact on the way the nation was feeling. They always made him a racist.
Mm-hmm.
It's not make America whiter again. It wasn't make America great again, right? Right from the start.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, and certainly, you know, it's a term that was made famous during the Ronald Reagan years, and the 45th president was smart to capitalize on a slogan that I think empowered people from all backgrounds to believe, again, as you mentioned, the exceptionalism of the United States, which, again, I would argue is still the most exceptional country in the world. Well, let me ask you this, because, again,
You mentioned the Magna Carta. The Magna Carta isn't something that was signed and boom, got done. It took 400 years to get that in place. Okay.
Yes.
By the time the concept, I want to make sure we all understand this. By the time the Declaration of Independence was signed, the king was not the problem. The judges were already the problem, and they knew that. During the debate in the Federalist Papers about the judges, they were very, very aware of the fact that the judges needed to be controlled because that's the way you get power, corrupt the judges. And that's what's happening from both sides.
No, listen, without a doubt, and I think it's a notion that is important for our audience to understand from a historical perspective. Let me ask you this, though. I checked out your site there, and there was a good column there talking about the socialist assault on our American liberties. And listen, I'm someone that talks about the evils of socialism. Again, obviously, you know, you have a Cuban background. I'm the son of a Cuban mother and the nephew of a Cuban aunt. I mean, I am someone who has denounced socialism and leftism repeatedly on this show. I'm one of the few journalists that talks about it consistently. I mean, there's really no other journalist in New Jersey that talks about it as avidly as I do because I'm knowledgeable about it. You know, my colleagues in the field just aren't, or they're unwilling to learn. but it sort of talks about more the idea of the assault on American liberty. And I think we're seeing that. We're seeing the attack on our public schools, and we're seeing it, I think, in every aspect of government. I know you're very much an opponent. Obviously, we're seeing that Cuba is in a news cycle. We're seeing rallies in New York City in front of the United Nations. Up here in North Jersey, there's going to be a third rally coming up next week. It's been throughout the country and, you know, parts of the Northeast. There's a real danger to how we look at socialism. And unfortunately, it's being embraced by the political elites, by academics, and I think others in pop culture. I know you find that disturbing too, though, right?
It's being coerced into society by the federal judges. The most coercive part of, look, prosecutors need the judges in order to coerce anyone, no matter how much they want to as their political enemies. They need the judges to coerce. And the coercion comes from corruption by the federal judges. And who is being coerced? Who is being coerced? People that believe in freedom, liberty, limited government, free enterprise, prayer, God, and the Constitution, the Declaration of Rights, and the Independence. We're being coerced. That's why I started my campaign. We're the ones that are being coerced, and it's a very powerful coercion. I mean, look at the way we're talking about Black Lives Matter, a Marxist organization, AOC, a Marxist, a socialist. You can't have that in the United States unless you violate the Constitution, which is our law. There may be a lot of written law, but our principles, our morals, our ethics come from the Constitution. All power comes from the Constitution, not the courts.
Yes, that's right.
The courts are limited to what's in front of two people before them.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a constitutional issue, it should not be something that's changing the country the way it is, that they determine, oh, the Constitution was, you know, this is constitutional, this isn't constitutional. After all, you know, we're killing babies. How could you reason that? How can you justify and legalize killing babies?
Mm-hmm. You know, well, I mean, again,
I'm sorry, but I can't see that.
No, man. Well, I get
that,
it.
If that's not something that you cannot legislate and you cannot regulate and you cannot judge under neutral principles, what is killing babies?
Well, man. Well, it's interesting you bring
that
up. What's
it doing in courts?
Well, listen, I understand that, and I think that since 1973, since the Roe versus Wade decision, what we have seen, you know, along jurisprudence levels, and also I think
millions of babies being murdered, and millions of women being taught that, and indoctrinated into the belief that murder is okay. That's what we're seeing.
No, Mike,
that's not going to affect elections. That's not going to affect the country is moving.
No, Manuel, I understand that. And again, listen, every election cycle, we know that issues like abortion, reproductive rights, as it's been coined now, you know, they become weaponized every election cycle, right? We've been seeing that ever since the Roe decision in 1973. And it's been challenged, right, in the courts. It's been challenged by legislatures, right? I mean, it's an issue that I would argue is one that's very polarizing because – it's not even so much about waiting for the courts to do something. I mean, individual states and legislatures now are taking it upon themselves to say, well, the courts have ruled one way. We're going to do something about it. And I think that's where you're seeing legislatures, especially in the South and the Midwest, not wait for the courts. They themselves have decided to be proactive. Again, and this is along ideological lines, some would argue religious lines, about how we look at, you know, reproduction and how we look at terminating a pregnancy. So I would argue that I think legislatures now are trying to get ahead of this and not wait for the courts. Now, again, eventually it goes to court. It gets heard in either courts of appeals or even up to the U.S. Supreme Court. I've always been saying consistently it becomes weaponized every election cycle. And here in New Jersey, which is a very blue state, I always tell all of my liberal friends, I'm like, I get it. You're always concerned. It's a lightning rod to get donations and solicit support. But a woman's right to choose to terminate a pregnancy isn't under attack in New Jersey or New York. So you don't have to worry about that. You know, maybe if you go down south, that's an issue. But here in the Northeast, which is very liberal, Manuel, people, I think, get into hysteria about, you know, limiting a woman's right to terminate a pregnancy. I don't think it's as much of a hysteria as people make it out to be. Is that fair to say?
Well, that's a very personal question. I'm sorry, but I think killing babies is a bad thing, and it shouldn't be. This is a Judeo-Christian nation. It was founded on the Judeo-Christian beliefs. And someone had to come to us as humans and tell us what's right and wrong. You know, it's wrong to murder. It's wrong. But wait, let me finish.
I'm with you.
You mentioned religion. This is supposed to be a religious-based country. We have to look at morality. Ultimately, we need to impose our own reasoning and our own ability to discern the truth, not go with this hoity-toity, you know, litigation and regulations and legal processes ad nauseum. Do you believe it's right, the right of a woman to kill her baby?
I don't believe in it. I'm against it. I'm not an attorney. I try not to argue with people who are attorneys or, you know, reproductive rights activists. I'm with you. I'm not a fan of the practice at all. But unfortunately,
reproductive rights. What is, you know, when you get the thesaurus out and you have to reproductive right, what does that mean? We're talking about the right to kill a baby. That's all we're talking about, not reproductive rights. As a matter of fact, if you look at the Judicial Conduct Act, you'll see that there are academic papers where the leftists and the liberals were deeply ingrained in the Biden administration are talking about eliminating the notion of parental rights at all. They question whether anyone has the right. Yeah, well, that's the kind of thing that goes on in the judicial conference, Fernando. Those kind of hoity-toity, you know, let's talk about this because we're all philosophers. They should be sitting on the court doing their job as judges, not trying to save the world or change the world, and not lying to change the world. They weren't put on there to change the world and make a better man. That's what Hitler was doing. That's what any dictator would want to do. It's the opposite of what America is. So the fact that we're sitting here discussing socialism in America is insane. Mm-hmm. Something's gone wrong, and what's gone wrong? The judiciary. The judiciary is where the leftists have taken over the nation, and the right has allowed it because they've gotten certain things, but not many. We've obviously lost more than one as conservatives.
I don't disagree with you, Manuel, about the fact that there are leftist elements that have infiltrated the judiciary. But can we also sort of make the argument that I think what's been just as complicit is also legislatures? I mean, what we're seeing is federal legislators getting elected that subscribe to intellectually bankrupt ideas like socialism and communism. I tell my students all the time, I mean, you know, sometimes the two words get conflated. And obviously, you know, being Cuban, both of us being Cuban, obviously we have a personal stake in this. What I tell my students all the time is like, hey, have you ever had difficulty explaining to people what the difference is? Because sometimes when you talk to socialist friends or people on the left, they're like, oh, well, you're conflating the two words. I'm like, no, it's very simple. Socialism is the notion that you think government can solve all your problems and you have faith that government will. So you're willing to relinquish your rights and liberties. Communism is simply, oh, we're just going to do it by force. So that's the simplest way to explain it to the audience, I think, and to my students that I talk to every semester. But getting back to your point about sort of the overt elements of socialism, I'm with you. I understand what you're talking about along the judiciary. But can't we make the same argument that probably it's more egregious in the legislative branch? Because, again, these are men and women getting elected to be legislators and writing bills. and passing laws. I think that's just as egregious, though, right? Or am I looking at it incorrectly?
Fernando. You've got 14 men and women dealing with the members of the executive in the Department of Justice. The presidents come and go, but the people in the Department of Justice that deal with the federal judges and a certain elite group of senators and House of Representative members in the judiciary committees, cutting deals that affect your privileges, your rights, your liberty, and your Constitution. Let's talk about that and worry about who's going to get elected. Didn't that come first? Didn't it all start from liberal branch claiming that they had a right to be more intelligent than anyone else, and they saw a better life, they saw a better vision for America, they saw injustices, the Civil Rights Act. Before the Civil Rights Act, there was no much civil litigation. It was a minor amount of the number of cases in the federal courts. Now it's 30%. 30% are civil rights. It ain't your civil rights. It's not the civil rights that are in the Constitution.
No, I mean,
if 14 people are sitting there doing things that the country doesn't know about,
okay,
and we're doing nothing about it. They've buried the Judicial Conduct Act. It's the essence of a dictatorship. It's the separation of powers at the federal level. Forget the state. Because if you do it at the federal level, then you have the 50 chief judges, and they'll do the same thing, which is what happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
No parent in America can get into federal court to protect their rights for custody over their children, religion, First Amendment rights, and freedom of speech is what is at issue. The future of the nation is what's at issue. Yet there is no constitutional protection, due process, no equal protections in family court anywhere in the nation. The states are allowed to do whatever they want with the family. And that's mind-boggling. And I don't want to get personal, but if they can do that and they can do open borders, doesn't it open your eyes? Open borders controls the borders. Did you need to build a wall, or should you have taken care of the corruption in the federal judiciary that opens the borders?
Well, absolutely. Listen, and without question, I mean, one of the things that's written into the document, and for our audience right now, folks, if you just joined us, it's 9:46 on the East Coast here on Blog Talk Radio. It's my pleasure to have on with me tonight on Politically Direct the founder and president of the Institute of Judicial Conduct, Mr. Manuel Asensio, here this evening with me. You just mentioned right now, obviously, about the borders. You know, one of the things I talk about on this program a lot, I talk with immigration advocates, both on the right and the left, and I talk about all the time that, you know, the word sovereignty and the preservation of sovereignty is written into the document. And I think people forget that, Manuel, especially those on the left, that the preservation of sovereignty and borders is the responsibility of the federal government. It's not something that's racist or xenophobic. I think people forget that. It's written into the document. It's one of the responsibilities of the executive branch. So when we're seeing that that's not being enforced, I think it's reprehensible. I think also, too, I think it's an indictment about the fact that the federal government doesn't prioritize it either.
Can we get past – is it possible to get past the notion – that citizenship is a dirty word in New York, that we should be citizens of the world, but there really is nothing good about America, that the process that made America great was meaningless because the founders owned slaves. It's insane to have that ingrained into the American society and children. That comes from the lawyers and the judges. How could we have a governor that gets away with saying America was never that great? If America isn't that great, where are we going to go? China? It's a joke. If you destroy the concept that America is great, because it relies on individual liberties and the protection of individual liberties, because we all know government is corrupt, right? Look what's happening with the inflation rate. They're lying about that. They're printing money left and right. That's completely unconstitutional. And they're doing it. They're getting away with it.
Well, it's been going on for a long time, though, right? I mean, I think regardless of who sits in the White House and the political parties that control the Congress, that's been going on for years, though, right? Or decades,
actually. Well, the manipulation of the inflation rate has always been an issue because the government needs to control the expenses, and they have a lot of expenditures that are regulated by the different consumer price indexes that they create in the Labor of Commerce, the Commerce Department, the Department of Labor. But hold on a second. Now it's worse than ever. We're printing $120 billion worth of money a month. And we've been doing it for a long time. And inflation is out of control, and there's no signs that we're going to stop. If government can print money, they take away the fear that people are going to rebel, because they're taking more taxes. If you print money, then you don't have to pay. Then you don't have to raise taxes. So people don't see that they are paying taxes by the inflation rate and the deficit spending that's being financed by printing dollars. It's part of the socialization, the Marxist, the dictatorship of America. How are you going to do that if you take away the controls on government that they've got to borrow money? And it's not as if, there's very little reasons by which one, you can't justify that. It's a scheme to get away with usurpation of power. How are you going to run a free enterprise economy, a capitalist economy, where the interest rate, the riskless interest rate in the world, what you make on the dollar, is negative? There are trillions and hundreds of trillions of dollars in the world trading on actual negative rates because of inflation, but because people are paying money to buy these sovereign pieces of paper, a piece of paper issued by sovereign with negative yields. But you get back less than you gave them. That's the type of liquidity we created in the world. That's a form of, that is socialism. That is capitalism. That is Marxism. That has to be looked at. Why did it happen? And let's go back. Well, let's start looking at the separation of powers violations by the judges who are talking to the legislators behind their back and cutting a deal with them, cutting a deal with the other, without going through the process, without going through the American way.
Well, when we talk again, and since you mentioned the American way, it seems, though, Manuel, that what you're referencing, I think, is sort of a multi-layered problem. And for our audience again tonight, I mean, and I'm very fortunate, I have a very educated audience, so I'm lucky in that regard. But you know, the issues that you're raising are ones I think that for many of us that are political junkies and politicals like myself, you know, they're issues we've been following for a long time. But it's frustrating too, though, because regardless of political party, it seems like we're kicking the can down the road economically. And to your point about inflation and about, you know, printing money, and we're diminishing the value of it, it seems that, again, I think both parties have become complicit for maybe half a century now, maybe, that this has become the norm in Washington at the federal level. And it seems that neither party is interested in trying to control it or rein it in. Is this fixable, or again, is this a multi-layered problem that requires a lot of different parties to participate?
Well, it would be fixable if we could enforce the Constitution in the courts, right? Hey, stop printing money when you don't. You're getting around taxing people. If you want money, tax them. Let's see what happens. See what kind of revolt there will be then. But you're taxing them by printing money and lying about inflation. That's simple. Let's enforce the Constitution. You can't enforce the Constitution if the federal judges are in on it.
Well, when you talk about enforcing the Constitution along the lines of, is it just simply the separation of powers, or when it comes to this specific practice, when it comes to printing money, again, for our audience that maybe isn't aware about the inner workings of the federal government, you know, where does that start at? When you talk about printing money,
okay,
where does it start at?
Wait,
the simple, the
how
Federal
do you
Reserve,
stop it?
The Treasury?
Why should it be a political issue? It's a legal issue under the Constitution. It shouldn't be done. Whoever gave them the right to print money that way and not tax and lie about inflation. You can't stop it because you can't go to the judges, and the judges aren't being fair. They aren't being reasonable, being correct. They aren't being understanding. It's an unreasonable thing. Anything that we think about that's unreasonable. Now, it comes from law. Law creates schemes that are preposterous. They're absurdities. They're political nonsense. If we would stop that, then the people, there would be a fear, the legislators and the executive branch, who are just running amok with the debt ceiling, the amount of debt, lying about the inflation rate, and printing money. There's no fear to that, just like there's no fear for you saying that abortion is a woman's rights issue. I mean, I laugh. I'm sorry. It's a very sad thing, but is it? Is it?
Well,
is it,
I mean, a woman's health
issue? I don't even get the reasoning.
Well, listen, I'm not in favor of the practice, man. Well, let me be very clear. I'm someone that has read about abortion laws and the way that they've been worded, and obviously
you're talking about killing babies. What do we say? Hey, should a society kill babies or not? Why can't we just be open about it to say abortion or, you know, women's rights issues?
Well, I would say
how'd that happen? How'd that happen in America, a Judeo-Christian country? How?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, again.
And how's it gone so far?
Well, since 1973, it's an issue
Yeah, but we don't need to get into it. This is, you know, everything is like that. Everything is like that. And you know what? We've got to talk about this in the 118th Congress, because the 117th isn't going to do it, right? So we need to take control. Republicans need to take control of both houses, hopefully, and make sure that we have a Democratic election for president in 2024. That's why I'm running for Congress to be a member of the 118th Congress.
And we'll talk about that.
This 117th isn't going to do it. This 117th had all this year to do it. They're not doing it. They're doing it the other way. Nothing really happened in 2020. Nothing's wrong with 2020. It was a bad thing on January 6th. It wasn't that. No process to evaluate the faithfulness to the Constitution of either the process or the results of the 2020 election. And if you're going to talk about faithfulness to the Constitution, you have to talk about the federal judges having issued 50 injunctions against the president that made him look like a racist. And then you go a little deeper and say, well, why did it happen? Where was Barr giving brilliant speeches about how wrong it was and doing nothing about it, including allowing the president, including allowing a trial judge in the Southern District of New York take the right of Trump to put the citizenship question back on the 2020 census? We've got to face that as Republicans. We can't go into 2024 without realizing that bad things happen.
No, absolutely.
And talking about them and coming up with solutions for them.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And speaking of
Republicans, that's got to happen in the 118th Congress, which is coming in January 3rd, 2023. And I want to be a part of that.
Okay, and we'll get to that in a moment about your candidacy. And you mentioned about Republicans, and certainly history is on the side of Republicans coming up next year during the midterms, because short of FDR in 1932 and George W. Bush in 2002, the opposing party wins the House during those midterm elections. So Republicans are in a really good position coming up next year where it's a 50-50 Senate and there are more Democratic seats on the line next November in 2022. And there's only a 4-seat majority for Democrats in the House right now. So historically, you know, unless the Republican Party at a national level and at the state level do a monumental job of just missing the target, they should be able to win both chambers of Congress and hopefully make the president's job a little more difficult, because obviously we don't want an overwhelming majority of leftists in the federal legislature, because that's going to be problematic. We saw what happened under Barack Obama in 2009, and still things didn't get done. Getting back to your candidacy, you know, obviously you're letting the cat out of the bag right now, and you're announcing your intentions to run for a congressional House seat. What prompted this decision? I mean, obviously, I know you're very invested in this cause, Manuel. We know how you feel about the judiciary. Obviously, our audience has learned tonight how you feel about the ineptitude of Congress to some extent. And I think the big question I'm sure you're getting asked a lot is, what's prompting you to run and want to be a part of the 118th Congress?
Well, the 2024 election is for the president is going to be held during the 118th Congress. If we don't openly discuss what really happened in the White House, in the Republican Party, by the way, because the president had the Article II rights to protect the office of the American presidency from the onslaught of the federal judges. That has to be discussed openly. Why did Barr allow that? What he could have done differently? What happened in the White House with Pat Cipollone, the chief of the White House counsel's office? And what happened with Mark Meadows, the chief, a lawyer who happened to be the chief of staff? Why was the president dismantled? Why was he a lone wolf? Why couldn't he protect himself against the so-called resistance, which is a term to describe, you know, a movement by people against a foreign force that's taken over your country? He won. He was president. He was put there by people that care about immigration. We love immigration, but you've got to teach people that America is great. You can't have immigration and teach people you got to vote Democrat because America is a racist nation. That's what we're talking about, really. Immigration is about taking over the country by people that are indoctrinated to believing that America is not exceptional, America is not great, that the Constitution is not a wonderful document, that what happened during the colonial period of America in the Revolution, and which was a great war won by a great man, George Washington, that these men understood what happened to the ancient Jews in Egypt, to the Romans during all of their history, the Greeks, and as you said, England. But England was the last part of it, and they were part of it. After all, they were lawyers, the colonial system under British law. These were great men that did a wonderful thing. And it is an exceptional document. And if you read it, if you read all those documents, the first Constitutional Congress, the second Constitutional Congress, where there were massive, there were tremendous amounts of philosophical, deep conversations about whether they should go to war against such a powerful force as England, whether they had the money and the will. And then they do the Constitutional Army. They elect George Washington, and they win. They declare independence and they win. My God, this is a great nation. And we won World War II. God Almighty. It's as if the Midway Battle didn't happen. It's as if the Battle of Bards, Bulge didn't happen. It's as if Americans didn't paratroop in to protect the, you know, there were men, and that paratrooped into the Battle of Bulge and didn't go inside for a year, including the coldest winter, right? They didn't go inside. They ate and slept on the floor for the world to protect it. And we're not, that doesn't count. Like Cuomo says, America was never that great. It's unbelievable.
Well, you know, Andrew Cuomo.
I personally have a doubt about virtue, about value, about my religious beliefs. I think those documents are as important as reading the Bible.
Oh, I mean, fair enough. And listen, I understand. I mean, there's, as you mentioned before, and I think for all of us that are students of history, we know that there's a Judeo-Christian.
What have the leftists got? Tell me, what have the leftists got? We've got the Constitution. We've got this great history and what came from it. Incredible human progress.
Yeah, man, well,
I agree. Show me a document with the Communist Manifesto.
No.
It was the 60
Manuel,
million Chinese that died with Mao Zedong.
Listen, Manuel, I'm
Fidel
I'm
Castro?
With you. Yeah, no,
Chavez.
I'm with you. Listen, you don't have to convince
me. We've got something to show, right? We've got something good to show.
Yeah, listen, we have
America works.
I'm with you. We have 245 years of progress, of being the beacon of light for the world. It's why people continue to immigrate here. It's like, again, we know that Cuba is in the headlines. It's why people for decades have jumped in little rafts in shark-infested waters to leave communism. And I say it all the time to all of my friends in academia or in media that are leftists or that embrace socialism and they're intellectually bankrupt. I'm like, you know, no one's jumping on a raft through shark-infested waters to go to Cuba or go to Venezuela. I mean, obviously, we, for 245 years, Manuel, as you've mentioned, we've been that example to the world. Are we perfect? Of course not. No government is. But we've been that blueprint of what a good and just democratic society should be, you know. But unfortunately, there have been a lot of hurdles and there have been a lot of, I think, missteps that we can talk about. Folks, it's 10:05 here on the East Coast on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be wrapping up shortly here with the founder and the president of the Institute of Judicial Conduct here, the great Manuel Asensio, who just announced on the air tonight he'll be running for a congressional seat coming up in 2022. So we do want to wish him the best of luck with that. Before we wrap up here, Manuel, though, when we talk about the impact of your organization, again, in creating the Institute of Judicial Conduct, has it been difficult to get legal professionals, again, attorneys or other scholars or academics, has it been difficult to have those professionals rally to your cause when it comes to supporting the Institute, to perhaps putting money behind it, to giving it mainstream attention? What's the success rate right now in terms of you talking to legal professionals and then getting on board with you for this?
Look, they make their money off of the Federalist Society was a central part of the creation of the federal judiciary policy that Trump brought into the White House. His idea of putting 200 conservative judges on the bench. Every 4 years, 200 judges leave, 2,400 of them. That didn't change a thing. And whether you put a conservative or a liberal in, they are the federal judges, and they see themselves as superior to us. They've been glorified by the federal bar to be what they've become. We're never going to get any support from them for a change in the Judicial Conduct Act of 1980 to take that power away. That's power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. And Roberts has absolute power in the United States. It's all about taking power away from government. So I never expected to have any success with that. My use for it was I am litigating my civil rights, and I knew that I wasn't going to be able to be successful. So I knew I had to litigate under the Judicial Conduct Act, which is why I got into the conference, and we'll see what happens, but this is really a political matter, and that's why I'm running for Congress, but not because of my personal issue. My personal issue gave me the knowledge and experience and information to be able to speak about these issues. But what we really care about is free enterprise, the rule of law, and the separation of church and state.
Manuel, let me ask you this, because I know that there are other organizations that try to raise awareness, that have become very visible in the mainstream. Like, for example, Judicial Watch has been a nonprofit that's been in existence for some years now. I can't exactly give you a start date, but I know they have been a very mainstream organization. Have you talked to anyone, for example, at Judicial Watch? Because it seems like they're very mainstream. I think they're trying to hold people accountable in all levels of government. Have you reached out to them? Have there been any communication or dialogue with organizations like that?
They're lawyers. There's nothing to talk to for lawyers that are making money off litigation. They're using the law. They're using the courts to litigate and then promoting the litigation to get donations. We're not about that. We're entirely an educational organization for the American people, to empower the American people, not to debate with the federal judges, the state judges, any judge or any lawyer. That's a whole different world. They're the occupying force. We Americans have to resist against that. We own the country. We own the First Amendment. We own the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and the Bill of Rights. It's ours, not theirs.
No, that's right.
Those great colonial lawyers were revolutionaries. They were taking their lives and their property and putting it at risk. There's no one at Judicial Watch doing that.
Yeah. Well, listen, that's
American,
a fair observation.
We're for the American people, and that's what we're not for, trying to reform the judges and the lawyers. The Federal Society. The Federal Society is the number one culprit in what happened in the White House. The idea of putting new judges on the benches that are conservatives as being the solution to a fundamental problem in our society, which is deliberate and malicious judicial misconduct that is organized under policies created at the conference. That's a lot of words, and I don't mean, it's terrible to speak. I don't like to talk, hoity-toity, and I hope it's not. Judicial policy should never influence our rights or anything that can touch on evidence or the merit of a case. If you have judiciary policies being made that are prejudicial, such as open borders or women's rights issue or global warming, open borders is a big one, but no one knows about domestic relations, but that's a black and white issue. Come on. You try arguing that with a judge or a lawyer. Well, why is it that parents can't get into federal court? It's pathetic. It's our courts. We're not citizens of New York. We are. New York has its constitution, but we have to have the right to get into U.S. courts to protect ourselves against the state judges. State judges can't get in cahoots with the federal judges. Okay, we're not letting parents in. How would we feel, even the left, how would they feel if you commit murder, you don't have any due process rights? and you still can't talk to them. Try. Bring on some people. Let's have a debate on your program with lawyers about this matter.
You know,
they write papers.
Manuel,
they argue.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, Manuel, listen.
Does it make sense to any American? No, it won't make any sense to American. No. But will ever get to America? No, it won't. But it might if I get to Congress, and that's not the issue. The real issue is judicial, the fabricated judicial policies behind our backs. Secret associations, secret proceedings, and secret oaths. Those are repulsive to Americans, and they must be stopped.
Well, Manuel, it's prompted me to think about getting more attorneys on the show here to talk about this and dissect it further. Before I let you go, number one, I want to thank you for your time. This has been a really informative and educational episode. I know our audience I've enjoyed it. I know I'll get a lot of feedback about it later tonight, if not tomorrow, with the replays and everything else. So I want to thank you for your time. You've been a wealth of information for me and for everyone tuning in tonight, Manuel. So I want to say thank you for that. I also want to give you the last word, sir. So we'll close out the show, but you have the last word, Manuel.
Fernando, secret associations, secret proceedings, and secret oaths are the words used by John F. Kennedy to justify him having been involved in the invasion of Cuba and the Bay of Pigs. That he gave that speech, that famous speech about secret associations, secret proceedings, and secret oaths on April 27th, the day he decided not to give air cover to the invasion that he helped organize, that he financed, leaving those people on unprotected when they were invading, those Cuban patriots. Nothing was done about it. He got away with it. I left Cuba 2 weeks later, by the way, on May 15th, 1961. I'm 66 years old. I'm living my 67th year of life. I was born in 1954. So that's very important to me. Secret associations, secret proceedings, and secret oaths. He had them, and he had the right idea. He needed to take a dictator out, and we still got him. Why? Because he messed up. But he got away with it because he came in and gave a wonderful speech, and he was a military man, not a lawyer, but he got away with it. He said, look, I did this thing, I'm wrong, and I should have talked about it, but that wasn't the issue. The issue is that he was supposed to take out Fidel Castro. What a different world he would have had if his secret associations, secret proceedings, and secret oaths were with his people to do it himself instead of doing it through some crazy covert operation where his airplanes were going to be painted over so they couldn't be identified as American planes. And then he changed his mind. That's my closing comment to you, because you're Cuban and I'm Cuban, and we should keep it personal. After all, you're in a you're in a Cuban neighborhood there.
Sure.
In New Jersey.
Well, I'll say this: that 62 years later would have been a very different America, very different Caribbean, very different Western Hemisphere, had that regime been thinking out. And hopefully, you know, we're seeing some advocacy about it now in the mainstream. Thank goodness. Manuel, I want to thank you for your time again. I thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us here tonight on Politically Direct. Certainly, folks, for everyone tuning in tonight, if you've just joined us right now and you missed any part of the broadcast, don't worry. This tonight's episode and a replay will be available shortly after we go off the air. It'll be available at insidernj.com/podcast. That's podcast, plural, with an S. You can listen to the episode tonight in its entirety, and certainly we welcome any feedback and comments on it coming up in the near future. But Manuel, I want to thank you for your time again, folks. He is the founder and president of the Institute of Judicial Conduct, Manuel Asensio, fellow Cuban, fellow patriot, and hopefully a member of the 118th Congress, as he'll be running next year in 2022. Manuel, I'll check up on you in the early fall. We'll see how the campaign's going. We'll see how this is going. And we look forward to welcoming you back here on Politically Direct. Have a great night.
Thank you very much, Fernando.
Have a good one.
Good night.
Good night. Folks, what a great interview tonight here with Manuel Asensio, again, the founder and president of the Institute of Judicial Conduct. A lot to unpackage there, folks. A lot to sort of unravel in terms of what the organization that he created means, what he's trying to raise awareness about. And it's a difficult job. It's something that has been really in effect for decades. And, you know, you have to admire a guy when he's looking to be a crusader in that way, and when he's looking to enact change for the better. And hopefully that's something he's looking to do. Obviously, as he just announced that he's running for Congress coming up in 2022, and certainly he's a guy you definitely want to keep an eye on for in the weeks and months ahead. We'll make sure to bring him back on later this fall as an update to what's going on with his not only his campaign, but obviously what's going on in today's political climate. Folks, that's our show for this week here. If you have any suggestions for a guest or topic coming up, I'd love to hear from you. It's always politicallydirectnj@yahoo.com. That's our inbox. Please write to me. Love to hear from you. What do you think of tonight's show? You know, what do you think of the guest? What do you think about my questions? What do you think about the answers? What do you think about the dialogue?
You know, I want to hear from you. So, again, write to the show, politicallydirectnj@yahoo.com. Don't forget to follow the show on Instagram, folks, at politicallydirectnj. I've been a little lax in updating that page, but you can always check out my personal Instagram, at Professor Fernando Uribe, and also on Twitter, at NoFilterUribe. And certainly, folks, for all you Facebook subscribers, please go to the official page for Politically Direct. Like it, of course, and tell your friends to do the same. And remember to check out Insider NJ, ladies and gentlemen, by going to their main page, www.insidernj.com, for the best coverage of what's going on in New Jersey politics and even federal things, too. You can always rely on Insider NJ for the best columns, the latest scoops, and obviously outstanding journalism and writing all the columns. Now, again, I might not always like my colleagues. They don't always like me. But I'm proud to be a part of the Insider NJ team because collectively we all work together to make Insider NJ arguably, actually not even arguably, unequivocally, the number one source for New Jersey politics online every single day via www.insidernj.com. Also, you can check out replays of the podcast, folks, at www.insidernj.com/podcasts. Again, that's plural, podcasts with an S. So definitely want to check that out, not only tonight's guests, but all previous guests, folks, are available there. You can download the episodes and listen to them on any PC, Mac, smartphone, or tablet. And folks, I can't say enough really how thankful I am to all of you for tuning in this week and every week here again via Block Talk Radio. And certainly without you, my very educated and loyal listening audience, without you, this show and the success that I've enjoyed with this program would not be possible. So always remember, ladies and gentlemen, if it's unbiased, unfiltered, and unafraid, you know it's always politically direct right here via Insider NJ. I am New Jersey's premier analyst, award-winning commentator, your favorite professor, again, the most professional journalist and top 100 Latino via the Latino Spirit online magazine for both 2020 and 2021. Fernando Uribe saying so long. Again, folks, we'll see you here next week on Block Talk Radio. And as always, let's keep on talking. Bye.